Thanks, everyone, for joining me again today. This is Eric Ellison, and today I'm with George Roth. I got to meet George in Phoenix, Arizona. He was doing some leadership and some work with us, facilitation with us for CASE. He's an educator, scholar, consultant, writer, currently doing work at University of New Hampshire, and then also has been at MIT for 20 years, co-founder of the Society for Organizational Learning, has studied, written about, and lectured on organizational learning, change, culture, and leadership, where he gets to apply his expertise as a scholar, practitioner, to conduct research in those areas, consult corporations, government, and other organizations. So, George, thanks for joining me. Quick question for people who might not be familiar with organizational learning. What is it real, you know, as you kind of get to communicate that with people? I study organizational learning and help organizations become better at that. How do you describe that for people?
So I think you have to start with how do you study it, not just what do you study. I'm an organizational sociologist, so I pay particular attention to how people work and the relationships they have with one another. My interest in the topic of organizational learning goes back to the late 80s, early 90s, where the person that I studied with, his name is Edgar Schein. Since emeritus from MIT, but is well known for probably having started the field of organizational psychology, careers, culture, leadership. Very accomplished. And as I was interested in my dissertation topic, I said, Ed, I really want to study organizational learning. Here's how I want to do it. And this is part of how I'll define the area. I'm not off on a total tangent. He said, well, you know, I don't think you should study learning in organizations because the psychologists have been studying learning in people for 50 years and they still haven't figured it out. So what I suggest you do is make that a little bit simpler, study organizational change, and then you've got a whole career to work on what is learning in organizations. And so I say that in part to answer your question that it is kind of a complex phenomena. The basic principle that we might look at is most organizations, and particularly from the perspective of a business school, have particular goals, and those goals have to do with maximizing shareholder wealth, satisfying customers, satisfying employees, the kind of the performance elements in a business. And so the design, the management, the focus in organizations is really on performance. The insights that I've had and worked with another colleague, Peter Senge, that's written extensively and maybe even might be considered the father of organizational learning, is the notion that in organizations, we're always performing. We never take the time to learn, and that what we need to do is create different practices in organizations that facilitate learning. So you've got both the performance track and you've got the learning track, and you know, you may keep them separate for a while, but clearly you want to try to bring them together. So the best way to describe organizational learning is, you know, how do you continue to improve over time to achieve the results that really matter?
So
and did I answer the question, or did I just go off on a tangent? So, I mean, people have been studying learning forever. There are learning curves, you know, just basically the mathematics of how you improve over time. We know that really well in manufacturing. I have been drawn towards the idea that we study it by putting into place practices that we then assess whether they accomplish the means that we have. So, while I've both been a more removed scholar, like a sociologist that doesn't really intervene in the organization that they're studying and just tries to describe that, I did that as an ethnographer for my dissertation. I've been more involved as an action researcher slash consultant, meaning that I'll help organizations put in place better processes to achieve the ends that they desire and assess with them whether that's actually happening or not, and then write about those as cases or examples.
Okay, so in The Dance of Change, going back to the late 90s, that book, that you wrote in, there's a quote that I found really interesting where you say that all organizations learn in the sense of adapting as the world around them changes, but some organizations are faster and more effective learners. The key is to see learning as inseparable from everyday work. How do you help, or how do the good organizations, kind of merge those two things where you talk about the production and the learning, kind of simultaneously?
Well, I think the example that probably gets talked about a lot in that and other work is that most teams that we're a part of, you were a baseball player and you're really tall, so you probably were a basketball player at one time. And you think about the ratio of the time that you practice versus the time you were actually competing. Right, you set aside time where you work to improve your skills so that when you're on the performance field, you're confident and competent. So the challenge that we have with management teams is oftentimes they don't do that. They're always in action, making decisions, solving problems, having meetings. So the first thing that we usually do is we slow down a little bit and say, we think it's worthwhile kind of stepping back and maybe learning some skills. And we have a set of tools. This is where Senge's ideas of the five disciplines, that there are particular areas that we study and practice that help us become more effective as learners, apply. So the one that I think has a great deal of leverage in terms of producing better results is this notion of mental models. And a mental model is kind of the assumptions that we have in our head about how the world works. It tends to filter even what we see. It certainly determines how we act. But oftentimes our thinking is just so practiced that we're not even aware of it. We just kind of do what we do because that was what we've always done. So how do we create opportunities for those kind of things to become more visible to people for themselves, so they see themselves, but they also might see it in others. And the idea of a learning tool is that we would expose ourselves, make our assumptions more transparent as a way to invite others to do that. And as we start to become aware of our underlying assumptions that guide our behaviors, we have much greater leverage in terms of then how we come together and act in ways that produce the outcomes that we desire. So, by the way, outcomes that we desire, that's the notion of shared vision. That's another one of the important learning organization disciplines, that as people, human beings, we all aspire to things, usually a better life, better relationships, in some cases more stuff, more money, material things, which is less important for those of us that have a different worldview. But the notion that we also understand one another's personal aspirations and collective aspirations and develop a shared vision that articulate the results that we care about, that we move to, that guide our actions. So we've got both the ability to talk about our thinking and what's in our mind, what conclusions do we have about one another, how do we interpret the things that we see going on in the world around us. We share a kind of common vision. And then we're probably halfway there. So the notion is that we have some time that we take to practice on management teams that will take, if managers have a weekly meeting, maybe they'll take an hour a week to learn some new methods and to apply them to the current problems that they face. So we're not trying to say, oh, learn this and maybe it'll apply, but learn this and let's see how it applies to the issues that we have today. Usually we find that it's better to take that and do that in parallel separately before trying to bring it together so we can develop better habits and processes that we then become a natural part of the way people work together.
And you, I mean, I was doing some research and reading, and there was a mention of, how learning is different than training. you know, in that the learning organizations, you know, this process of challenging mental models or developing new skills, or, you know, it's embedded into, you know, the organization where training is kind of this pull out and you do it at these different times.
You train your pets and you educate your people.
Yeah, right.
So, but you know, I mean, that said, I think it's just the use of the word training.
Okay.
That were there. So, I mean, organizations do have training programs. The question oftentimes is, what's the desired outcome? Training may be very good to learning a set of skills, but it doesn't really address people's aspirations and concerns and passions. And the whole idea of a learning organization, and I use the word aspiration instead of motivation, because we want people to think about, what do they really care about, and how are they going to have an opportunity to one, be in touch with that and act on that through the work that they do. So aspiration is like aspire, and it includes the elements of breathing life into, inspire and aspire do. So we look to that element.
So when you see organizations, and we've been through massive, you know, kind of economic adjustment and changes in your career, you know, you've probably seen a ton of change.
I've been through a ton of change. Yeah. Never mind seen them.
Is there an organization out there, or is there, you know, like a company out there that you've watched or you've, you know, kind of paid particular attention to or been involved in that you admire for how they've embedded, you know, this organizational learning and the concepts into their, you know, their, who they are as an institution?
Well, you ask a tough question.
Okay.
Only because the reason that I say that is because of an organization, you know, show me an organization. Okay, you know, give me an example of an organization.
Big company, like, yeah. One of the auto companies or tech companies or.
Okay. So let's say General Motors or sure. Let's say Ford. So you go to Dearborn and you see world headquarters, right? And you say, there's Ford. I'd say, no, that's not Ford. That's the building that Ford's world headquarters are in. So I think one of the dilemmas is that organizations are simply legal entities that are empowered to hold assets and manage the resources that they have. They exist on paper. What exists in reality is groups of people working together in buildings and factories with resources and all that. So the challenge that I have in answering your question of give you an example of an organization, you know, that is really good at these practices, it tends to be, unfortunately, ephemeral, meaning that it happens for a period of time and then it goes away because largely the people change. So you'll note that I wrote a book called AutoCo, which was about the use of the learning organization methods in a large auto company in a product development process. I'm not supposed to say who that company is, so I don't need to say that. But I think during that time, there were a lot of elements that those leaders put together that worked on that project for that time. That auto company, a couple years, actually toward the end of that project that was going on, went through a change of CEO. The new CEO wanted to bring in a particular set of methods. He threw everybody else out of the company. Vilified maybe other techniques so as to focus them on what he said he wanted to do. So the social and equity, social capital that was developed through that process very quickly dissipated. And I could probably go through another whole handful of companies that were quite successful for a period of time, maybe at the CEO level, maybe at a divisional level, that had these characteristics and then changed. One that I will mention, for a period of time, I was working with a refinery in Port Arthur, Texas, and the general manager of that refinery had come from a refinery out of Ohio. The large oil company had sold it off to a refiner, and they private equity firm, and they moved him to their biggest refinery in Texas. And he said, a part of the reason they bought it was it had gone through a significant transition in terms of improving its learning principles and practices, and it become kind of a, even for a smaller refinery, a best performer. And they wanted to bring those practices into the Texas refinery that they had bought, which was much larger. So he started a process. He had a continuous improvement forum. The whole workforce of about 2,000 would be invited, and sometimes we had as many as 400 or 500, because obviously they're running the plant at the same time. And in one of those, I was invited to help him with a process, and I was giving a talk, and then afterwards we were kind of doing a workshop, and I was going around to different tables, and a couple of the guys said, "What are you doing here?" I said, what do you mean what I'm doing here? This is never going to work. You know, there's just going to go back to the ways always things always were. And I said to them, I said, you know, I hear what you're saying, but I got to tell you that I believe the general manager here is sincere, because I wouldn't be here if he wasn't. He's committed. And he's also said very clearly, you know, this is the way we're going to work as long as I'm the general manager here. And I think I said to them, I said, you have the choice. You can either buy in and maybe see if it works or not, or you can sit back and ensure that nothing ever changes here. So I said, you're as empowered as you are, and you have a choice. And I do really believe the general manager is sincere. He wants greater transparency. He wants this to work. And he's committed, and he's also realistic. He said, it's only going to happen as long as I'm here, because I can't promise you what happens afterwards. And I think that's really what the call is, that as managers, general managers, plant managers, and even CEOs, we only have a window of time, a window of resources, a window of acceptance with our board. Everybody has a boss. And, you know, one of the greatest challenges is, you know, as long as the economy is good and you are able to produce results, you're allowed to keep going. I think like many things, if you believe in good process, it produces good results, but other stuff happens in the economy, in your industry, that may set you back. And the question is, do you have the support of your board, do you have the support of your boss, that it allows you to continue? And therefore, you also have to be realistic with people, that as you put in place these ideas, which I would agree are virtuous, but I do believe that they're also fundamentally consistent with how we as human beings are made and wired, that you'll succeed. So, I even had, you're reminding me, I had Peter Coy, who is the business editor in Business Week, once call me and say, you know, how do I know that this organizational learning stuff really works? And he was interested in, I think, the notion that if you take the book value of corporations, or the market value, and you look at the book value on the books, there's usually a gap, and that gap has something to do with the assessment of the human potential that the organization has, meaning that market value exceeds the book value that you carry there because of the people that are there. And how do you leverage and develop that better from an economic perspective? And while I would say that there is a financial calculus that you can do to assess that, I think it's a much harder thing to think about the social and human and organizational processes, which really kind of liberate people to work at their best and align that for themselves, for their customers, for their shareholders, you know, to kind of keep the whole thing in balance appropriately.
So when you work with, you know, companies, organizations, teams, leaders, because that's something I've been thinking quite a bit about is the people side of things, how to, you know, liberate people or within, you know, within the institutions or within teams to do great work and to do that great work together. The bureaucracy tends to kind of create systems and processes that maybe limit that, or, you know, new managers, new leaders, new initiatives, new changes. And then we look at kind of some of the data out there, especially in education, where teachers, you know, people are not becoming teachers. Current teachers are disengaged from the system. I think, you know, your story about those plant, you know, workers, you know, the refinery workers, where this is never going to work, you know, is kind of a tendency of teachers now, where there's a real significant frustration because of the disempowerment that's maybe happened over the last, you know, decade or two. Like, how do you how do you help people, or how do you re-engage people, or how do you just value as a leader, or what do you encourage leaders to do to really kind of look at the people that you have to really build them up and to value them and to empower them to, you know, bring life, you know, to that organization or to, you know, that team?
You know, I think it's a really great challenge. And I'll tell you, I say that because my sister is a teacher in Arizona. So, you know, I've been following all that she's gone through, and all that she's gone through is culminated in, you know, what happened last week was, I think it was last week, right? And they just started back the beginning of this last Friday, they started back. And there were many years before where, you know, it was one cut after another. And, you know, basically there is so little left that they finally had to stop. What do I encourage leaders to do is to be honest. I mean, that's one of the things about the Port Arthur general manager there that I so appreciated. He said, here's my commitments. Here's what I can commit to do. It's only as good as I am here. And I don't know who will be here after me, but I can promise you that this is what my commitment is. And he was quite sincere, because if his management didn't support him, he would have left. And obviously people would have suffered hardship if they brought in a different kind of leader. And I think the same thing has to be said in schools too, is that you start with being honest with people. You trust them. I mean, teachers, my gosh, you know, my sister's buying school supplies. She barely makes enough to live, but she's buying school supplies for her kids. And that, you know, how many teachers in Arizona are working second jobs, and how long can people survive that way if they have a family to feed, just because they believe in the kids and in public education process? So I don't have an easy answer, because that's a very difficult situation when you really don't have the resources to do the job. You know, I just talked about the idea of, you know, taking time when you have meetings, you know, in addition to the tasks that you have to do, to invest in yourself, to learn some skills, to learn some practices, to make you more effective as a team. You know, can you really ask teachers to do more when you've already cut them back to do so little? Now, that said, I think there are some practices in schools that are very effective, and I've been involved with some people that have tried to put system thinking in schools. And you know, they get grants, they get extra resources to do that. They have a period of time, and a lot depends upon, you know, the head of school as well. And when the head of school changes and the school board has a big impact on the head of school, what they're allowed to do shifts as well. So, the thing that I find that works best is the inspiration people get from visiting other schools and seeing what they've done. There's nothing that speaks more loudly to that and then to say, wow, what if my teachers could behave this way? What have they done here that has allowed them to work as a larger system? And, you know, that's part of the question of, you know, is it possible to do things differently? That probably happens in a lot of schools. And then to figure out what the challenges are, what those limits to growth are, the resources that we talked about earlier, that people see and say, yeah, we would like to work this way. So you've got to have an inspired leader. I mean, one of the things that you and I have talked about is how do you get heads of school networked with one another so they can really learn and support one another, rather than, you know, I know heads of school may be competing with one another because you've got people that are regionally close enough to do that. But at the same time, you also want them to see, you know, what are the practices that really work? How do we inspire teachers? What are the techniques that they use to improve their teaching, to improve what they offer their students?
And don't you think even in that networking side of things that there is a, you know, you've talked about transparency and honesty, that even in that networking side of things, or even when visiting another school or organization, that transparency and honesty just leads to the relationship that allows for kind of that quality to, you know, kind of, you know, flow throughout, you know, an area or a region or even, you know, a profession.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's a big part of it. And I think it's transparency, not just in giving compliments, but in transparency in, if you see something you don't understand or you might question it, to engage. It's really just about, you know, about engaging in an open and honest way.
So George, let me ask one personal question on this side of things. Like, what's the most fun part of your job or your work?
Well, you know, it's doing things like I did with you guys. Was that in February that we were in Phoenix?
Yes.
Working with you? So the opportunity that I had was Stephen Levy. His wife was a teacher at Covenant School, now called New Covenant School in Arlington, Massachusetts, where our children were going. It's a Christian school. And my wife volunteered in the school and then became kind of a co-teacher with Joanna Levy. So I've been friends with Stephen for a long time. And as he was making a career transition, there was a reunion at the church, a 40th reunion anniversary of the church that had founded the school that we went to. And Stephen and I sat together at breakfast and we just started talking in an open, honest, and transparent way about what was going on in our lives. And he was telling me about this. And because of my work as an academic and doing some consulting, I said I would love to support him in his transition in whatever way was there. And part of his transition also included becoming a fellow at Case. And then when you were having your retreat, Stephen volunteered me as a potential person to facilitate your planning session, which is some things I have done for companies, but never, and churches I've been a part of, but never for a center like Case. And so I said, yes, I'd do that. And after I said it, I said, why did I do that? Because I was teaching four classes at the same time. And it was a huge burden, but it was in terms of time. But I felt like I'd been on a vacation. And you know how hard I worked that weekend. You know, I got the room that had the conference table right next to it. I had all the flip charts and everything ready. But because I was doing aspirational work, you know, we came in, we looked at what your visions were. You know, I know there's no question that a place like Case is how we preach and make sure God's word reaches the ends of the earth in terms of equipping our young people. And all, everybody there was committed to that. And I could take what I knew to kind of put together a day and a half workshop for you guys to think about what's most important for you and how do you organize to do that. That's the most fun in my work, but I don't have that many opportunities to do something like that that's centered on Christ's kingdom. I call that kingdom work, but I have other opportunities to do it where maybe in a secular, beneficial way that leaders are really trying to bring into place better practices that not only make them successful as a business, but also liberate and empower their people as a part of that.
George, thanks for taking the time and sharing your expertise with me.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure, Eric. Thank you. And